This is an ABC podcast.
Mālo e tau mai pōngpōngi ni, ko hau e gitu pōngpō, ko taritari fifi aki motorum, ki mō kau mai ke pōla mako ni, ko I Pacific Beat. Yes, good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, and we come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Today on the show, Samoa government is ramping up its response to a deadly dengue fever outbreak. Cook Islands are in celebration mode for the 60th anniversary of the nation's self-governance and free association with Aotearoa New Zealand. And shortly, we'll cross to Tonga to get the latest on a former LDS missionary arrested for allegedly sexually abusing minors. More on those stories coming up, but I say mālo pito. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, to Tonga, where locals have welcomed the news that a former missionary from the LDS Church has been arrested in the United States for allegedly sexually abusing minors in the kingdom. A statement from the US Department of Justice says 28-year-old William James Purdy was indicted by a grand jury on charges related to the exploitation of minors outside of the US. Court documents say the accused first travelled to Tonga in 2017 as a missionary for the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints and worked at a local school where the alleged crimes were committed. Now, to find out more about this case and the impact it's having in Tonga, I'm joined now by our reporter, Marion Kupo. There I say, malo tau mai pōngpōngini, Marion.
Malo tau mai pōngpōngini, Aggie.
Yeah, look, not much good news about this story, but look, what can you tell us about the charges that Mr. Purdy has been indicted on?
Well, obviously, like you've mentioned, according to the US Department of Justice, William James Purdy has been indicted on two serious federal charges. One is on sexual exploitation of children, and two is transporting a minor with the intent to engage in illicit sexual conduct. Now, Aggie, these allegations involved at least 14 boys here in Tonga during his time, both as a Mormon missionary and then later as a teacher. Now, the court document also outlined that there was also a pattern of grooming and abuse that allegedly spanned, you know, throughout the years. Well, that's what we're looking at with the charges laid against William Purdy.
Okay. Well, Marion, the US Department of Justice says that Mr. Purdy travelled to Tonga in 2017, right, where he worked on mission for the Church of Latter-day Saints, and then was later arrested in Tonga in 2022. But what do we know of the circumstances around this first arrest?
Purdy was first arrested in Tonga in October 2022 after an 8-year-old boy came forward with these allegations. He was briefly jailed, but later released on bail. As part of his bail condition, his passport was taken away from him. However, it's now alleged by the U.S. authority that he submitted a fake passport using another person's identity here in Tonga, fled Tonga to Fiji, and secured an emergency US passport at the embassy in Fiji before returning to the United States.
Wow, that's a lot of work. My goodness. Now, through a collaboration, yeah, though, between the US and Tongan police, now we know he's been arrested, yes, right, and indicted by a grand jury. What then has even the Tongan police said about this?
Well, I can just remember that the Tongan police did lay the initial charges that was made in 2022. The Tonga police also commented on the collaborative efforts between the local team here in Tonga, which is the Tonga police, and the U.S. Homeland Security Investigation and the U.S. Diplomatic Security Services in America, which also led to Purdy's arrest in the U.S. Now, this case also underscored the critical importance of the international cooperation in pursuing the justice and protecting the most vulnerable. Tonga police is also it's also understand that the Tonga's director of public prosecution also remained in contact with the affected families and has cooperated with them, also with the international authorities since Bertie's disappearance. So there is been work here on the ground, and they're still pursuing and connecting with the victims' families.
Yeah. And before we get to talking about the families themselves, how has the Tongan community, though, themselves reacted to this news?
Well, Aggie, there's been a strong emotional reaction here. People are shocked, particularly because many of the alleged victims are from remote, close-knit communities. Online, there has been a call for more safeguard to protect the children, and many are expressing frustration that someone under serious allegations was able to flee the country.
Well, Marion, look, I know that you've actually spoken with one of the families of an alleged victim. Is there anything that you know that you can share? What have they been able to say about this?
Well, yes, I did. I spoke with one of the close relatives of this 8-year-old boy that came forward, and they said, and I quote, "Although this event occurred in 2022, the drama remains deeply present in our lives, particularly for my young nephew. We humbly ask for sensitivity, compassion, and common sense when speaking on this matter." Well, they're urging, that was a quote from the family, Aggie. They're actually urging the public to be sensitive and respectful, especially online, and reminding everyone that these cases happen to real children. And the family also thanked the other families who came forward and praised Tonga's Director of Public Prosecution, you know, for their tireless work and also keeping them up to date on this case, even when the accused fled the country. So they're calling on others to report abuse, but by saying, you know, if it happens in silence, so speak up, protect the children. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And look, what a brave thing for that young 8-year-old to come forward, and of course the other victims too. Marion, look, I know probably they may not want to say anything, but has there been any word from the Church of Latter-day Saints in Tonga there in regards to this news?
Not yet. We did reach out to the Church of Latter-day Saints yesterday, and most likely we might be expecting a press release from them. We will not confirm when, but we most likely will expect this press release, because it's very important to note that these allegations related to Bertie's time in Tonga as a missionary and then later as a teacher, and both roles were allegedly gave him the access to vulnerable boys, and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints might most likely will issue a press release to say their stance in this case.
All right, Marion, look, thank you very much for updating us in regards to the situation. It is obviously a developing one, so we will keep updated and stay in touch with you. But again, malo apito, Marion. And that was our reporter, Marion Kupu, speaking with me there. Now, look, if this has raised any issues for you, please reach out for help. For those in Tonga, you can get in touch with the Women and Children's Crisis Centre on 22 240. That is 22 240. For those listening in from Fiji, you can call 5626. That's 5626 for the Empower Pacific Helpline. In Papua New Guinea, One Talk Counselum Helpline is available on 7150 8000. That is 7150 8000. And finally, to Samoa, you can contact the Samoa Victim Support Group on 800 7874. That is 800 7874. Thank you for tuning in to Pacific Beat.
Join Sosa Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Whakawelahi, and thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. Now, Tuvalu's Prime Minister says his country will continue to keep Australia accountable on its carbon emissions despite an economic and security treaty between the two governments. Speaking at the Australian and National University in Canberra, Whiriti Teo says the impacts of climate change have become a lived experience for his people. He says the Whalepili Union Treaty with Australia is helping deal with the impacts of sea level rise, but at the same time would not weaken Tuvalu's stance on climate change.
Despite our renewed and elevated diplomatic relationship with Australia, it does not restrain us from calling for Australia to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions or to halt export of fossil fuel. Tuvalu's survival depends on all nations to rapidly transition to renewable energy. And we have been assured that Australia is on target to reach its renewable energy target of 83% renewable electricity by 2030. And in terms of greenhouse gas emission of 43% below its 2005 level by 2030 and net zero by 2050.
And that was Tuvalu's Prime Minister, Whiriti Teo, speaking at the Australian National University yesterday evening. Meanwhile, the ballot draw for Tuvaluans applying to permanently live in Australia will be announced late today. More than 8,000 Tuvaluans have applied for the 280 slots available this year. Oh, we head to Samoa now, where the government has ramped up its response to a deadly dengue outbreak. The country has activated the National Emergency Operations Centre and has closed schools for 1 week for a nationwide fumigation. Since April, when the outbreak was declared, there have been more than 100 cases a week and 2 deaths. So joining me now for the latest on the ground is our reporter in Samoa, Adele Fruin. That I say, malore soifua, Adele. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Well, look, I mean, what's the current situation with case numbers in hospitalizations? Are they still rising?
Yes, that's correct. Last week alone, a total of 498 cases were confirmed of dengue. Now, this is just out of 900, just over 900, actually, that were suspected cases. This is according to the Health Ministry's data. Now, since January of this year to this month, now they've confirmed over 2,000 cases have been confirmed. Yes. Now, in terms of the, you know, critical conditions for patients, so far no one is, you know, has been admitted, you know, for critical conditions in terms of the impacts from dengue as of yesterday. But however, total number of patients that are confirmed to be at the main hospital is approximately 27 patients, which includes, I would say, the majority of them are children.
Wow, wow. Adele, I know that the government is responding, but how are they responding to this outbreak?
Yes, government has responded by closing all public schools, private mission, and even universities, actually. You know, all schools are closed, ensuring that fumigation works are underway. Now, that's not the only thing going on in Samoa trying to counter or also respond to the outbreak. Villages around Samoa are working to clean up their properties to ensure that it's easier for the fumigation teams to carry out their work. So yes, that's what's happening right now.
Yeah, and as you say, obviously the community seems to be responding. Are they responding well to know that this fumigation is necessary?
Yes, that's correct. The majority of village councils, now you're looking at village councils. Now, once when village councils are involved around the country, you know, everybody must comply now, you know, and it's evident by just going past on, you know, some of the villages and you'll see people out, you know, cutting grass, you know, especially with the trees as well, just clearing out a lot of their properties. So this is just to ensure that the work is easier for these teams to carry out. So, yes.
Well, Adele, as you mentioned earlier, you know, about the amount of cases, like 498 cases. But how are the local health facilities coping with that surge? You know, like particularly in treating young children who are the ones that are mostly affected?
It has not been easy for our health facilities, especially our doctors and nurses, to cope with hundreds of patients. We're talking about hundreds of patients to treat, you know? And with just, now, not many people know this, but the total number of doctors locally, you know, for Samoa, you know, it's just over 100.
Wow.
And you're looking at close to thousands of people to treat here and just trying to cope with just 100 or just over 100 around the country, basically. So I also, 2 weeks ago as well, it was really bad. It started getting worse. You know, this was around the time when, you know, we had a lot of patients, hundreds kept coming to the hospitals. I went to the hospital, you know, to take my nephew. He also had dengue fever. And that's when we saw how bad it was at the hospitals. You know, so many parents were there. The children were crying, you know, and even some were just sitting on the floor, basically. It was really bad, jam-packed everything, you know, and it was really, you know, disheartening to see because the parents themselves were not only panicking, but they were scared because they've heard that, you know, we've confirmed 2 deaths so far for dengue fever, and no parents wants to go through that sort of experience, you know. And the first thing that comes to their mind, take the children to the hospital, basically. So it has not been easy for our local health facilities to cater to this high demand and need.
But how more challenging has it been then in trying to reach, you know, those rural or even remote areas with I suppose, the health messaging or even mosquito control efforts?
Yes, now the National Emergency Operations Centre is working in close collaboration with various government agencies. Now, you're looking at, you know, Red Cross, you're looking at the education system. But the most important key to reaching these rural communities is the Ministry of Women, Social Development. They are the key to reaching our village representatives, or we call them village mayors, basically. So they're the ones that will send out the message to all villages, all village councils, to ensure that, you know, to please, you know, look out for the young ones, and also to ensure that the properties are cleaned up properly, and to just await the fumigation teams that are coming around to do this work. Yeah, it's really, I would say, it's a difficult, you know, difficult situation we are currently in, in the sense where, you know, all of a sudden this happens. You know, it was like, it's like trying to picture the times with the measles, when all parents were flooding the hospitals. And, you know, dengue fever, you know, when it was announced, like around April, about the dengue outbreak, there wasn't, you know, a lot of members of the public were just not concerned. You know, they were like, oh, okay. But nothing was happening because we didn't have a lot of cases. And now we are in, you know, July going August, and it's getting worse.
Well, and this is the thing, though, Adele. What are the authorities saying, you know, about how long this outbreak might last? And, I mean, are there concerns it could worsen further?
Yes. During a press conference yesterday by NEOC, or the National Emergency you know, Operations Center, they you know, they stated that government you know, is still keeping an eye on the outbreak, and they are hoping that their efforts with the fumigation works going around the country, the cleanup work, this will try and counter the you know, the outbreak, that, you know, in case it worsens. But only after all of these works are carried out, then they will have a sense of whether it actually worked or didn't work at all, and then it's going to get worse and worse, basically.
And that is something I know, Adele, you will keep us up to date with, but I just want to say whaftaitele lava for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Aggie. You have a lovely day.
You too. That was our reporter in Samoa, Adele Fruin, speaking to me there. Pacific Beat. Yes, I'm your host, Aggie the Bull, here on Pacific Beat. Well, look, we just finished speaking about the dengue fever outbreak in Samoa, because now it's hoped outbreaks of this disease could soon be a thing of the past in the Pacific through the use of new technology which immunizes mosquitoes against the illness. It's part of a larger project which is helping researchers to understand how mosquitoes spread the disease. Dr. Leon Hugo leads the QIMR Berghofer Mosquito Control Laboratory in Brisbane, and he says the work his team is doing is helping to change lives in the Pacific.
We have an insectary where we keep what we call a living library of mosquito species, and we're able to conduct various research into the mosquitoes themselves and also the arboviruses and parasites that they transmit. We conduct studies to determine the transmission cycle of these arboviruses and what better ways to control mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes know no bounds in the sense that they're not just tied to one country. How does the work that you guys do here in Australia, you know, is it focused just on Australia, or is the work that you do can also be applied to other countries, say, in the Pacific?
So we have the capacity to work on viruses that affect both Australia and the Pacific. So the research that we conduct is equally relevant to the Pacific. So we work on ways to detect the virus in mosquitoes. We establish which mosquitoes can transmit the virus. We also work with partners to build a capacity for identifying the vectors responsible for transmission of these viruses and ways to control them. Because by controlling the mosquitoes, we control the diseases that are caused by these viruses.
Dengue fever outbreaks are currently occurring across several Pacific Island nations, including Tonga, Fiji, the Cook Islands, Samoa and Kiribati. What's the kind of difficulties, you know, in from your, you know, 25 years of work in this space that you might have noticed between, say, combating, you know, something like dengue fever in Australia versus, you know, entering a region like the Pacific? What's the differences there in terms of how you can really mitigate and combat disease, given it's not every day that we're seeing a dengue fever outbreak in Australia?
So in Australia, in my time working with mosquitoes, I've witnessed the development of a brilliant strategy to control dengue, which is the use of a particular bacteria called Wolbachia, which is a class of bacteria that naturally infects many insects. And this bacteria caused the mosquitoes to be resistant to infection with dengue virus. The strategy is being rolled out now by the World Mosquito Program to dengue endemic regions around the world. It's occurred in Indonesia, in Brazil, in Vietnam, and slowly but surely, I think we'll see the dissemination of Wolbachia-infected Aedes aegypti mosquitoes to regions that are still prone to regular outbreaks of dengue, including those nations in the Pacific.
In May, in Fiji, they reported nearly 9,000 dengue cases nationally. So whilst we seem to have a bit of a handle on things here in Australia, you know, in the Pacific, it's a bit of a different story. As a scientist, do you see a future where we're not having outbreaks in the Pacific? Like, is that at all possible, or is it always going to be something that's just kind of managed?
So with the advent of technologies like the use of Wolbachia bacteria, yeah, I'm hopeful that this technology will be transferred to the nations in the Pacific, and that the mosquitoes there will be immunized against dengue. In the meantime, we're partnering with nations in the Pacific to better prepare and prevent epidemics of diseases like dengue by identifying the mosquitoes where they breed, and to partner with them to better control and remove vectors of these diseases, and thereby the opportunity for transmission.
We understand so much research is happening here in Australia, and here at James Cook University in Townsville, there's a lot of work as well. Is any of that work, you know, in collaboration with the Pacific?
Yes, indeed. So there's a project called the PACMOSI project, and the aim of the project is to raise the capacity of researchers in the Pacific Islands to understand transmission patterns, identify mosquito vectors, and to know how best to control these mosquito vectors.
And that's Dr. Leon Hugo, the lead at the QIMR Birkhofer Mosquito Control Laboratory in Brisbane, and he was talking to Lucy Cooper.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
All right, taking you now to Palau, where scientists and oral history custodians are joining forces to piece together the story behind some of the Pacific's most ancient monuments. Buried beneath the jungle are huge pyramid-like structures called terraces, but the origins of these structures have been forgotten to time. In a new episode of the ABC's Pacific Scientific Show, reporter Sophie Lee travelled to Palau and discovered how they are using lasers and lost stories to uncover the secrets of the terraces.
It begins to rain, but through the stormy weather, in the distance, I can see the rolling hills of Aymalik, which, from the outset, just look like regular hills covered in jungle. But beneath the green growth are the ancient terraces.
Everywhere you look would be terrace. Across from us is a terrace. There's 2, 3, 4 terraces down there. Across the way, it's also all terraces.
Huge, man-made structures that Palau's oral histories have very little to say about. But Leilani says there's one story, a legend, a myth that she can tell me.
This, you see the hills across, that's Ale'ui village. And the story we have there is the legend of a serpent that was wrapped around the seven hills. It was so big that it was wrapped around the terraces. And it looks into the village, and every time it sees the smoke, it figures there's people there, and it'll go in the village and eat the people.
The story goes that the village people decided that they needed to escape the snake and got in their boats and fled. But they left behind an old lady.
She stayed in the village, and according to the legend, the gods felt sorry for her. So one of the gods mated with her, and she bore 2 boys. And then the boys, when they were growing up, they kept asking their mom, how come we're eating raw taro all the time? Why can't we cook the food? And finally the mother told them, we cannot cook because if we cook, the snake will see us and it will come and eat us. So what the boys decided one day to come up with a strategy to kill the snake.
They made a pile of rocks on each of the 7 terraces and set the stones on fire to attract the snake. They used prongs to stuff the snake's mouth with the burning rocks, burning it from the inside.
The boys killed the snake. They part of its intestine in a bowl and sent it out into the sea to go find the inhabitants of the village that have left. And so they said, oh, the snake is dead. And so they all got back on the boat and they came back to the village.
When the villagers tried to return home, the boys had blocked the water channel, so they couldn't get in.
And they were begging to be let in, and they had to concede to what the boys' conditions were in order to get back to their village. So it's sort of a story there with a moral behind it, that you have to take care of the least in your village, but at the same time, there is sort of a relationship of people from this village to the one from the northern village.
It's an important story with a great lesson, but unfortunately, it doesn't reveal anything more about how these terraces came to be, or why they are even here. Despite this, Leilani has been interested in them since she was a child, and says that even though they are covered in thick vegetation, that this is actually a recent development, and that when she was young, you could see them as clear as day.
When I was in elementary school and in high school, there were no trees, so these were so visible. You can see them from, you know, out in the ocean, you can see them really clearly. But since 2004, actually, until now, we've just had rains, nonstop rains. In addition to that, Palau created a law that prohibits burning, open burning. So people used to use fire to keep the grass down and to farm in these lands, but that kind of stopped. And so I think combination of those 2 factors really encourage the growth of the jungle, pretty much what you see now on top of these terraces.
She stayed fascinated by the terraces her whole life. And in 2007, when she was elected as Aymalik State Governor, she saw an opportunity to highlight their importance.
even before I came into office, I was very excited and interested in having them featured and highlighted. We started working on getting the information together for the terraces to be part of our tourism product. You know, I think it's something that people need to know more about. But even then, we didn't really have a lot of information. The research was still very limited.
But with new research being conducted, it's shining a light on just how technologically advanced Palau's ancient peoples were.
We're estimating over 35% of the land is altered as a terrace. I think it says a lot about the people that were here before, about the knowledge they had on hydrology, maybe their engineering. So it would be interesting, not only a story for Palau, but for the Pacific. There's always the idea that the people in the Pacific were the last people to have technology and to have this knowledge, but it's or that the knowledge is restricted only to sailing. But this is opening a whole new window to look into the past.
And to hear more about the oral history and science work happening in Palau to uncover the secrets of the terraces, you can tune in to Pacific Scientific later today at 9 a.m. PNG time, right here on ABC Radio Australia, or you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Whātālofāts and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Of course, it is time to head around the region to get your latest headlines with our news wrap that's brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, who's in the studio with me this morning. How are you doing, sir?
I'm well, Aggie. Nice and recovered from my big weekend of yes. Heartbreak with the Wallabies. But,
sorry. Yes. Hey, but look, thank you very much for looking after the show yesterday. I really do appreciate that. So,
not a problem. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Look, there is a couple of stories circulating. This first one here is Nauru wanting to transform its economy by becoming a cryptocurrency powerhouse. How does it plan to do that?
Yeah, it's a good question, Aggie. And the answer is by way of an Australian finance director who was flown to Nauru with some lofty ambitions. So his name is Brian Phelps. He's the new chief exec of the newly minted Command Ridge Virtual Asset Authority, which is a firm which creates a licensing and regulatory scheme for digital asset transfers, cryptocurrency being one of them. And the idea basically is to set up a foundation for digital money to be able to flow freely into Nauru and potentially set an example for some other countries to follow suit.
Wow, which I'm sure many people are going to be thinking, how will that actually improve Nauru's way of life?
Yeah, well, that's the million-dollar question, millions and millions of dollars, potentially. He said it could be transformational for some key revenue streams. The one he listed was remittances, and in order to do that, you do need a stable infrastructure and Bitcoins in place. And to be fair, traditional remittance payment systems have become somewhat more risky. I know recently that Australia's financial crime enforcer, AUSTRAC, audited Western Union, which is the Pacific's largest remittance provider, and found a number of gaps in its anti-money laundering system. That being said, look, we all know crypto's been around for a while now, and it still seems to be a long way from becoming a sort of a mainstream currency. So there's still a lot of work to go before I think crypto becomes the answer.
Which I just have to quickly ask, do you even understand how crypto works?
I don't, Aggie.
I still don't.
I'm a bit of a simpleton, I think, when it comes to this stuff. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'm still yet to walk into a shop to find two payment options, one being my regular bank card and one being crypto. So until I see that, I think I'll continue to not understand.
All right. Okay. Now let's switch to Guam, though, because Guam's think tank says the island's major missile defense upgrade is more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah, that's right. So the Pacific Center for Island Security has cast doubt on the proposed missile defense system's capabilities, flagging a number of limitations about the project's environmental impact study. So they challenged this idea that the system is even needed to counter the threat that China potentially poses, noting that while it's designed is to deter adversaries from attacking the island, it's actually only designed to manage a small-scale or coercive attack as opposed to major ones, such as, the potential Guam killer, for instance, from a place like North Korea. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they say promoting it as something to prevent a huge attack is potentially uncertain, if not a giving off a false sense of security. Meanwhile, PCIS have also raised concern around the natural impact it will have on Guam, such as the housing crisis, as well as the degradation of the native habitat. And ultimately, they just concluded the project would introduce a new level of weaponization to Guam while offering minimal benefits in terms of increased security. So, yeah, strong words.
Yeah, crazy. Okay, now, beloved Vanuatu footballer Brian Kaltek has found a new home. Is that right?
That's right. The 31-year-old, he's said goodbye to the Central Coast Mariners, where he won two league championships and signed with the Perth Glory on a two-year deal. So I was a little bit sad when I read this, to be honest. I actually had become a bit of a Central Coast Mariners fan, just based on, you know, getting to speak to him and cover him during my time at Pacific Beat. Really humble guy, amazing player. It was such a Cinderella story in the way he got that opportunity in 2022 and made the most of it and became essentially one of the league's best defenders. But he's left now. He's taken on a new opportunity with Perth, and he actually made his debut on Sunday against the Wellington Phoenix in what was the first round of the Australia Cup, which is a sort of a national knockout competition that includes teams from the A-League and state level, kind of like an Australian version of the FA Cup, I suppose.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they did lose their first game with Caltech. They lost in a penalty shootout, and it was actually Brian who sent the ball over the crossbar and kind of paved the way for the opponent to seal the match, unfortunately, so he missed. But look, that being said, very early days, and I'm sure he's going to have a great career at Perth. And I actually saw an Instagram post as well of Vanuatu flags in the crowd. And yeah, so I imagine he'll be taking his fans with him.
Loyal fans, I can see right there. Well, look, as always, Carl, thank you so much for coming through and giving us some of the headlines from around the region. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Aggie.
Inzane Rugby League on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by ABC Sport commentator Zane Bojack. Inzane Rugby League is a weekly look at the lighter side of rugby league, featuring game insights, latest news and interviews with rugby league legends and from around the edges. So close to the action, you can almost taste the turf. Inzane Rugby League, Tuesday nights at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
Kia rana. Well, we head back to sport now. Since it was founded in 2007, the Indian Premier League has grown to become the most popular and richest cricket competition in the world. So could India's Rugby Premier League, which has just completed its inaugural season, become equally successful? Six teams of local and international sevens players took part, including Fiji's two-time Olympic gold medal winning captain, Jerry Thuai, and a number of others from the Pacific. And the coach of the Chennai team that won the tournament was Ben Gollings, who led Fiji to World Cup final success in 2022. Richard Hewitt has been talking to Ben about the potential impact the new competition could have on rugby sevens in Oceania and whether more and more players from the region will be tempted to go where the money is.
All in all, there was 35 top flight, what you'd call your marquee players involved. Each team had five, and there were a number of Fijians involved. And in fact, there was a few replacements between when the draft was done and then when we actually got to India. And I guess one of my big draw cards was the ability to sign up Apeli Maliko from Samoa as what they call a bridge player. There were three levels of player: Indian, local, bridge player that were foreigners, and then marquee players. And that gave us a really good balance then. We had a very strong set of foreigners across the field.
I presume one of the key elements of what this tournament was all about is developing the game in India. And of course, another famous Fijian name, Wasali Serevi, has had some involvement there prior to this tournament working with the Indian team. But looking forward, if this competition goes anything like the IPL in cricket, this is going to be a huge draw card in years to come, isn't it, for professional players from around the world?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we were very impressed with the people that were involved and the kind of vision they had for this moving forward. It's not just a 1 year, let's try it and see. They're looking at 10 years and they've got the right people involved, and certainly I'm sure they'll add more franchises next year. This will really grow. And from a sevens perspective, where we're starting to see a bit of a decline with the World Series and the number of teams that are in it and the number of tournaments, this is a fantastic opportunity for players to get remunerated. At the moment, a lot of that's capped, but who knows where it could go. We've seen what IPL's done. What I learned when I was in India is that this type of model works well in India. They've got the population, they've got the interest. And from the first round of the RPL, I think it made a lot of impact. And it's definitely going to have a huge impact in terms of where India can develop its rugby program. So I think it's exciting and it's good for rugby.
You hinted at the World Series perhaps not being in the best of health. And I know there was a lot of disquiet about the way the competition rules were changed just 2 or 3 days before the final series. There is a lot of unhappiness, I think, about the way the World Series is headed. I mean, can you see a situation in the not too distant future where players would rather opt to play in a tournament like the Rugby Premier League in India than play in the World Series?
Yeah, I mean, a big focus for players is security. And what we've seen is Ireland suddenly no longer have a program. We've seen Great Britain go from a full-time program to no longer having a program and all their players and staff coming off contract. We've seen Samoa miss out now, so they have to qualify. There's a distinct lack of security for the players, and this could provide that important security. I mean, you can only play the game for so long, so the ability to maximize that whilst you're able to play is really important. And I think this is a fantastic opportunity for them. And is it there to replace the World Series? No, I mean, you can't, because it's the World Series is the international game. That's where you represent your country. But certainly from a domestic sevens level, this provides a great opportunity.
But the club versus country tussle that occurs so often in so many sports, and particularly in the Pacific, this is another, isn't it, tug of war looming?
It is. But I'm very intrigued to just see where the sevens space heads up, sevens space in particular, because we have seen World Rugby make some changes. And obviously we want to see sevens stay at the international with its Olympic inclusion. But I just wonder whether it's hard to create the sustainability at the international level like it's had in the past. And I just think with the way the world's moving, it may be that this domestic competition takes over in terms of taking on the financial burdens and providing more security for players. And then there's a certain amount of tournaments that they play internationally, and hopefully there is alignment amongst that.
So careful management, it seems to me, is required on an international scale to make all the parts fit.
Yeah, but I think it's something that really needs to be looked at, because I think there is an opportunity here that presents itself that could have a very positive impact specifically on the sevens game.
How did the tournament go down in India? Cricket obviously is the dominant sport, but what were the attendances like and what was the fan reaction like?
Well, I think this year there was a big focus on it. It didn't matter about how many people are in the stadium. Hence why a smaller stadium was picked, but with a good field. And really, it was about the media, the TV, and getting it out to the masses, if that makes sense, and making it accessible, which is what kind of social media platforms do. And I think there was a lot of uptake. From what I learned when I was in India, is that the Indians like competitive, combative sports. And that's, really with rugby, that suits it. And it's a short format of the game, so it keeps all parties involved in it and focused with it. So from what I'm hearing, the impact was really good. And it really got far and wide within India. And a lot of positive comments coming back. So hopefully it continues to have that impact, because the crowds coming in will start to happen year two, year three.
And that is Ben Gollings, former coach of the Fiji Men's Rugby Sevens team, who led the Chennai Bulls to the inaugural Rugby Premier League title in India. And Ben was talking to Richard Hewitt. Now, a cover-led boom is unfolding on the roads of Vanuatu's remote islands, with growers buying four-wheel drives with cash. Prices have reached an all-time high as popularity grows overseas, particularly in Australia. Michael Luze has been exporting cover from Vanuatu for over 25 years. He told Lucy Cooper cover is becoming a more mainstream daily habit outside the Pacific, which is helping drive demand.
Many things have changed, and actually cover has been sort of a revolution in the South Pacific, in a sense that prior to cover, the economy was based on colonial crops. And I mean, by colonial crops, I mean all the crops that were introduced by France or the British in the 20th century or even before, like coffee, cocoa, coconuts, copra, this kind of thing. And now cover has taken over, because it's way more rewarding for the farmers. And this is what is driving the economy in Vanuatu. Like, more than 70% of the export revenue of the country are due to cover export. That's not including also the huge domestic market, circulating much more money for the farmers and the communities around than any other activities.
And what about the price? How's that changed?
No, that's very good, because people often have some short memory sort of thing. And of course, everyone wants to have the higher price possible. Like, I got to tell you the example. I think in 2003, the price was 20 times lower than what it is now. In 22 years, the price has been multiplied almost by 20, more than 20, yeah, for some more for the product, for the farmers. In 2003, I was working in Malekula and I moved to work in Santo. There was only one Chinese guy, Aman Leong, buying kava. And he was paying 200 vatu for ships and 150 for roots. And at that time, I was working for Balele Trust, and we started to challenge him, and we paid 200 vatu for both products. Today, the farmers are getting 2,600 for the ships and 3,000 up to 2,600 or more, 2,800 for the roots.
Why is that?
Well, because of the global demand, more demand, and more local demand too. Yeah, I think the industry has structured itself fairly well. Overseas market have developed, and kava is a great product, so people are asking for it. And of course, competition slowly have done this over the years. Of course, right now the price is has never been so high in history, probably because also it's short, and when it's short, there is a sort of people are fighting for it, I would say. The supply is not low. The supply is big, but not as high as the demand is.
Why do other countries want it?
There is many factors, but why it's in high demand in other countries? Simply because it's a great product, and it's a great. People are trying to move away. You have a big trend of the population trying to move away from alcohol. There is no real alternative if you want to socialize, and that explains the success of kava bars in the US, for example, and even in Vanuatu. Like you know, like we are seeing this trend, and the domestic market has increased a lot. A lot, crazily a lot, because it's a great alternative to anything.
Have you seen, you know, kind of real life impacts of that increased price, that increased demand benefiting, say, farmers and yourself?
Of course. Like, if you travel to the rural areas in the kava producing islands, in Pentecost, or in, well, I could name almost all the island, like in Santo, and you'll see the impact of the kava industry. We never had any commodity empowering the farmers as much as kava. Farmers are buying long trees and cash money. I'm sure that even in Australia, farmers are probably asking credit to the bank to buy long cruisers. But all farmers manage to pay cash money for long cruisers. And if you travel to the hotel, to the island, to Pentecost or to South Santo, you'll see the number of vehicles, you'll see better houses, water system, solar system, farmers investing in land, in town, building houses. I think a typical example will be Luganville, the Santo town. The city is booming because of the kava boom, because the farmers have money and they spend the money in the shop in town.
Where to next for kava and kava exports? Do you expect it to grow in the coming years?
Our challenge now is to grow production, because the kava producing nations are quite small in size. We've a lot of challenges in terms of scaling up the production. We've got many of our youth also going for a seasonal workers program in New Zealand or in Australia. It's bringing remittance back in the country. But at the same time, we are developing Australian and New Zealand agriculture. And of course, the absence of those youths in the farms is also a limitation for the kava development. We need to find ways, and that's what we are trying to work on now with the different stakeholders of the industry, as how we can boost the production to answer the increasing demand, whether it's by better farming system or incentive to young farmers to show them that they can make better money working on their farm, growing kavas and going and pick up, I'm saying, apple in Australia, for example.
And that is kava exporter Michael Luze. And that brings us to the end of A Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, well, locals in Tonga have welcomed news that a former missionary, William James Purdy from the LDS Church, has been arrested in the United States for allegedly sexually abusing minors in the kingdom.
These allegations involved at least 14 boys here in Tonga during his time, both as a Mormon missionary and then later as a teacher. Now, the court document also outlined that there was also a pattern of grooming and abuse that allegedly spanned, you know, throughout the years.
And that's ABC's Tongan reporter, Marion Kupo. Now, we'll be back at the same time at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned. Your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Jacob and Michael on Nija Daily. So until next time, o tua whātou. Have a great day. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Aloha lava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.